Court.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, a look at the barriers to healthcare in prisons.
We live in a country founded on the principle that all people are created equal, but unfortunately our attitudes, our policies, the way that we treat people don't always reflect that.
But first, the report that changed the field of medicine for better and worse.
The medical world was segregated and biased all the way through American history. It mirrored American society.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Flu, COVID-19, and RSV can keep your older loved ones from the moments that mean the most, like graduations, birthday parties, or Sunday dinners. Last season, unvaccinated adults were about twice as likely to land in the hospital from these respiratory infections as people who had their vaccines. Don't let that happen. Help those you love get vaccinated this season. Get started at vaccines.gov, paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
What's better than one win? Three wins? With Straight Savings, you keep your own phone, get one line for only $25 a month with real unlimited data, and get rewarded with a $200 phone credit after 12 months. It's a win-win-win. Head to Walmart or visit straighttalk.com today. Switch to Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense. Straight Savings plan enrollment requires compatible unlocked device and new line of service. Bonus device credit requires 12 months of active service. Offer ends if eligibility requirements are no longer met. Taxes and fees apply. For network management practices, see Straight Talk's terms and conditions.
Last week, we discussed the creation of America's first modern medical school and how the practices we use today rose to popularity over traditional and folk medicine. Part of that rise was due to the American Medical Association. While this institution is now a prominent part of the medical field, it held very little power when it was first founded in 1847. It started out as an organization for state and local medical societies, leaving out the individual physicians. But when it reorganized in the early 1900s to focus mainly on the providers, it finally had a chance to become a powerhouse in this space.
Medicine was becoming more scientific and gaining more acceptance because of that. So the AMA took advantage of that, in a sense, and made it an organization of physicians, included people like homeopaths if they would agree to the new ideas that were being accepted in the general world about science and medicine.
That's Dr. Todd Savitt, a historian of medicine in the Department of Bioethics and Interdisciplinary Studies at East Carolina University's Brody School of Medicine. While the AMA was able to decide who to let into its organization, people who practiced alternative medicine also had a decision to make. Would they give up their beliefs in favor of a more scientific practice? Savitt says many of them refused, so the AMA continued to usher in this new age medicine without them. One of the main upgrades it looked at was the quality of education physicians were receiving at the time, which Savitt says was severely lacking.
There was very little regulation of medical schools by even within states, and certainly not at any national or professional level. So the AMA wanted to do that from the very beginning, to kind of organize medical education on a national level with national standards for medical education so that you get good physicians everywhere.
So in 1904, the AMA created the Council on Medical Education, a group that began to evaluate and rate medical schools. They surveyed more than 150 schools and decided that only half of them could be considered acceptable. As a result, dozens of these institutions folded, and many others were on notice if too many of their students failed the state exams. It wasn't always necessarily a product of bad education, but rather a lack of resources.
In order to have laboratories, in order to have good dissection materials, in order to have good clinical facilities, in order to make medical education modern, you needed money. Most of the schools, white and black, existed not on endowment money, but on the fees of the students who paid to go to medical school, and maybe a grant or two from a foundation or something, but nothing like what we see today. Most medical schools ran on a shoestring and did it with student money.
As medical schools all tried to meet the same standards, they had to find money for additional faculty and new facilities like hospitals and research labs. With most of the colleges already hanging on by a thread, many couldn't keep up with the new demand. Between 1900 and 1910, Savitt says a number of them were failing. The final tipping point, which has had lasting repercussions to this day, was the Flexner Report. The AMA, in partnership with the Carnegie Foundation, recruited Abraham Flexner in 1909 to conduct his own assessment of the country's medical schools. The catch? Flexner had no experience in the field. He was a high school teacher and founder of an experimental college prep school.
Flexner was an educator from Louisville. He was not a medical person at all. His brother, Simon, was actually educated at Johns Hopkins, and maybe that's where he got the idea, a model of medical education from. So Flexner used that model as he went around the country. He went with some folks from the AMA, from the Council on Medical Education, and the Carnegie Foundation.
Flexner used the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine as his gold standard.
Johns Hopkins was a newly established medical school in the 1890s. It was based on the European model of medical education that included laboratories, dissections, and anatomy laboratories.
It also included a four-year education. Almost every other medical school only had two, and Savitt says students took basically the same courses both years with very little clinical work. Johns Hopkins' structure was much more involved, each class built on what students learned in the previous one. The first 2 years focused on the body and disease, while the last two had students go out into hospitals and work with real patients. It's the foundation of the structure we still use today. Using this model as his standard, Flexner, along with representatives from the Carnegie Foundation and the AMA, went to over 150 schools in America and Canada. There were seven Black medical colleges and two women's. Nearly all of the others were all-white schools. As expected, there were a lot of bad ones.
When Flexner went around, he was pretty ruthless about deciding or saying what was wrong with schools, white and Black. So it isn't that he went around and singled out the Black schools as being not up to standards. A lot of white schools didn't do very well, if you read the Flexner report, because he actually itemized, after a long introduction about what ideal medical education is, he went state by state in his report with each school and talked about every school and its strengths and failings. What Flexner did by publishing this report in 1910, sort of spelling out all of these problems of the medical schools, he cemented, in a sense, the fate of schools that were not doing very well.
By 1935, more than half of the colleges had merged or closed, leaving just 66 left in America. Only two of the historically Black medical schools were left open. Due to segregation, most of the white colleges refused to admit African-American students, and it dramatically lowered the number of Black physicians. While the report was pivotal in getting us to the state of modern medical education, it also had detrimental effects for African-Americans that persist to this day. In fact, the AMA issued an apology in 2008 for its past history of racial inequality.
You could argue that the medical schools that were closed were bad quality and therefore didn't deserve to stay around, and too bad that we lost all those Black doctors. But the other way to have done it would be for Carnegie and Rockefeller foundations to support Black medical schools just the way they did the white medical schools like Vanderbilt, Rochester, Johns Hopkins, to keep them, to support them, Columbia, to keep them going and entering this new modern medical world. Those two foundations did not support Howard and Meharry or Leonard Medical School here in North Carolina in Raleigh or any of the other schools that might have had a chance had they been given funding. So the net result is that Black physician numbers declined hugely, and we're still recovering from that.
However, Savitt says that the Flexner Report wasn't the cause of this major setback, but it did feed into the racial discrimination.
The medical world was segregated and biased from all the way through American history. It mirrored American society.
And though the medical field's made a lot of progress, it hasn't been able to fully heal the scars of the past. The National Medical Association estimates that only about 5% of U.S. doctors are Black. Savitt says that his own students talk about the challenges still present in the Black community, such as trust issues.
There's a trust, somewhat of a trust issue. I think that's being overcome and it's changing, but there's still reluctance among some people of color to see Black doctors. But more than that, it's that the number of Black physicians is small. It's difficult to get Black students into medical schools and then graduate and go out into the big world. I think we haven't made up the deficit that the 20th century history gave us when we started, let's say, the 21st century.
You can find more information about Dr. Todd Savitt and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield. This segment is brought to you by Capital One. With no fees or minimums and no overdraft fees, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One, N.A., member FDIC.
Coming up, how our health system is failing the incarcerated population. When Radio Health Journal returns.
Mom, meet Sarah.
From first time Nana moments.
Welcome to Flight 101.
To annual girls trip moments. Your can't miss moments are worth protecting against RSV. If you're 75 or older or 60 plus with a chronic condition like asthma, COPD, heart disease, or diabetes, you're at higher risk of being hospitalized from RSV. And there are no prescription RSV treatments. Check eligibility and schedule your RSV vaccine at vaxassist.com.
So where should we go next?
Sponsored by Pfizer.
Spilled your drink? Quick, the quicker picker-upper. Bounty picks up spills quicker. And each sheet is 2 times more absorbent, so you can use less than the leading ordinary brand. So, you can get back to your night. Bounty, the quicker picker-upper.
The majority of Americans are unsatisfied with the healthcare system, and the problems only get worse when you put a magnifying glass up to certain communities. The incarcerated population, for example, has numerous barriers to care unique to the system they live within. In fact, studies show that each year spent in prison takes 2 years off of the inmate's life expectancy.
As time goes by, they're aging, but there's an accelerated aging process that happens for people who are in prison because of the adverse conditions that they're living in, inadequate access to exercise, nutritious food, poor air quality, and then poor health care. And so people have this accelerated aging where they're experiencing the onset of conditions at earlier ages than they would if had they not been incarcerated.
That's Dr. Emily Lopez, a physician and assistant professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. The shortened life expectancy may come as a surprise, especially because of a Supreme Court ruling back in 1976. It states that not receiving adequate health care in prison is a violation of the Eighth Amendment's protection against cruel and unusual punishment.
So this actually makes people who are incarcerated the only population in the U.S. to have a constitutional right to health care.
But this right doesn't automatically guarantee high-quality care, or even good access to care. Lopez says a main downfall of prison healthcare is the speed of which a person's request is filled.
In general, people submit a sick slip, and then that gets processed. Sometimes it can take days, sometimes it happens immediately. And then what will happen next is somebody will be seen by, could be a clinician, it could be a nurse, it varies facility to facility. But because of this, you know, if somebody has a real problem that needs to be seen by a clinician, it could take days to see a clinician. And during that time, the condition could worsen.
And that's just scratching the surface. To get a better sense of why the health of inmates is so much worse than the general population, Lopez led an investigation. It was recently published in the journal JAMA International Medicine. And though it aims to provide a snapshot of the current problems, a big hurdle that Lupez's team encountered was outdated statistics. Though they used the most recent available national data, that research is from 2016.
The 2016 data was not released to the public until late in 2022. So, you know, even though a new iteration of this data was initiated last year, there's really no telling when it'll be accessible to the public, which is one of the big problems in understanding and addressing health issues for people who are incarcerated, because it's hard to know what exactly the problems are right in this moment when we don't have data on that. And data is just not collected very frequently. And even the data that is collected is often very sparse and doesn't capture the full picture. There's not a lot of data sets on health of people who are incarcerated in general. And then there's even fewer that allow you to look at comparisons between private and not private facilities.
But since these are the only numbers Lupez is able to work with, she forged ahead. Unsurprisingly, the results are bleak. The prison healthcare system is inherently different from the rest of America. They don't have access to private insurance, and if they qualify for Medicare or Medicaid, it's often restricted while they're incarcerated. Despite this, people in prison do still have to pay co-pays.
Unfortunately, a lot of facilities do charge co-pays for at least some visits. I also was quite shocked when I learned about this, especially knowing that the minimum wage for prison jobs, at least at the time of our study, was between 4 and 40 cents an hour, which is quite small.
At the time of her study, copays ranged from $2 to $8 a visit, depending on the facility. The state of Texas, however, was an outlier. They charged a $100 copay that covered the entire year, whether inmates accessed care just once or on a consistent basis.
So at the time of our study, there were 42 states plus the Federal Department of Corrections that had copays. Since then, three states have eliminated them, Virginia, California, and Illinois, and that Texas copay actually went from $100 per year to $13.55 per visit, up to $100 a year. So maybe better, maybe not, hard to say.
Lupez says that copays are in place to control healthcare costs in two ways. The first hope is that it will be a revenue source for the facility.
But what we know from several studies is that the amount of revenue that copays generate is either nothing at all or less than 1% of healthcare costs. And there was a study done in Oregon that looked at their copay system. And in order to administer copays appropriately, it was actually going to cost, I believe it's $3 to $5 per visit, cost the Department of Corrections $3 to $5 per visit because of all the administrative burden associated with charging copays.
Which means that they're not an effective revenue source. However, copays do a good job with their second task, which is to deter unnecessary care. In fact, Lupez says they're too good at discouraging inmates. Since people in prison have such low wages, they have to prioritize what's worth spending their money on.
It can go to the commissary where they can get access to additional food, but also things like, for women, tampons, which aren't always provided by the Department of Corrections. Another thing that money has to go towards is letters and phone calls to loved ones. So this is really generating competing priorities for somebody to have to make a decision about where to spend their money. Furthermore, many of these people come from impoverished communities. And when people who are incarcerated don't have funds, it often falls on their families who are in impoverished communities to send them money. And so then we're just kind of creating this vicious circle of poverty and making communities that are already impoverished suffer even more financially.
Going into debt also isn't a great option for many people. In several states, leaving the prison while still owing money will block the person from being able to vote or get a driver's license.
It's not just like, okay, maybe you don't have any money in your account while you're in prison because you had to pay these copays. No, that debt follows you outside of prison. It then goes to collections. And then because it's a debt to the carceral system specifically, you can be denied things such as driver's license and voting rights. So I would say it's a pretty drastic impact on people who are incarcerated, both from the health perspective and financial perspective.
According to Lupez, many people in this tough position choose to completely forgo medical care altogether. So while the copays aim to repel frivolous appointments, it also stops people with chronic conditions from seeking care.
What we saw in our study was that people with copays were less likely to access care. And the measure of access that we actually did was having a single any doctor's visit since being incarcerated, which is a pretty low bar if you think about it for people that are incarcerated for many years and have chronic conditions. Out in the community, we would like to see those people, you know, multiple times a year. So for people to be incarcerated for multiple years, have a chronic condition, not even be seen once is a pretty bad thing.
Letting these health issues go untreated leads to worse outcomes and creates more expensive problems down the road that can affect the rest of America.
For example, from an infectious disease perspective, if there are outbreaks in prison, that can translate to more outbreaks in the communities when people are released. So an outbreak in a jail, for example, can easily translate to an outbreak to a community. Similarly, an outbreak in prison can be translated to the community through visitors and the correctional staff that are there working every day and then go into the community. When people come out of prison, you know, the burden is being shifted from the prison system to the community healthcare system to take care of people who are now worse than when they went into prison. And then, you know, our country in general is struggling with strains on the healthcare system. Our healthcare system for people not in prison is also not perfect. And adding more people that are sicker coming out of prison to that system is also a further strain on the system, too. So, you know, it doesn't just impact people who are incarcerated. It impacts the surrounding communities and the broader community as well.
But even if these problems were isolated to just prisons, Lopez says we still need to fight for all Americans to receive timely and adequate health care without having to decide between a doctor's visit or extra food.
We live in a country founded on the principle that all people are created equal. But unfortunately, our attitudes, our policies, the way that we treat people don't always reflect that. So from my perspective, people who are incarcerated are still people. They're entitled to their basic human rights as well as their constitutional protections.
You can find more information about Dr. Emily Lopez and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Greg Johnson.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
Heart valve disease affects more than 5 million people in the United States, yet 3 out of 4 adults know little to nothing about it. That's why the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is raising awareness by launching a series of toolkits focused on providing information, resources, and personal stories. Dr. Janet Wright is director of CDC's Division for Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention.
Heart valve disease occurs when your heart valves don't work like they should, which makes the heart strain and work harder.
CDC wants to help everyone get to know their heart.
Early diagnosis of heart valve disease is critical, so don't ignore anything that feels off. We know that early detection is only possible when patients and healthcare teams work together. Ongoing conversations about family medical history and heart valve disease risk factors can help identify when additional care or treatment is needed.
Visit cdc.gov/knowyourheart for more information. That's cdc.gov/knowyourheart.
What's better than one win? 3 wins? With Straight Savings, you keep your own phone, get one line for only $25 a month with real unlimited data, and get rewarded with a $200 phone credit after 12 months. It's a win-win-win. Head to Walmart or visit straighttalk.com today. Switch to Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense. Straight Savings Plan enrollment requires compatible unlocked device and new line of service. Bonus device credit requires 12 months of active service. Offer ends if eligibility requirements are no longer met. Taxes and fees apply. For network management practices, see Straight Talk's terms and conditions.
Flu, COVID-19, and RSV can keep your older loved ones from the moments that mean the most, like graduations, birthday parties, or Sunday dinners. Last season, unvaccinated adults were about twice as likely to land in the hospital from these respiratory infections as people who had their vaccines. Don't let that happen. Help those you love get vaccinated this season. Get started at vaccines.gov, paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Medical notes this week. We're diagnosing brain cancer quicker than ever before. Glioblastoma is a fast-growing, incurable tumor with an average survival rate of 12 to 18 months. Every moment counts for these patients, and scientists have now created a device that can diagnose the cancer in less than an hour. The technology, showcased in the journal Communications Biology, uses a biochip that can detect markers found in a blood test. All body fat is created equal, right? Not quite. New research in Nature Metabolism reveals that longtime exercisers have healthier belly fat tissue than non-exercisers. They can also store fat more effectively for their health. The study compared two groups of adults with obesity, one with regularly active people and one where no one worked out. The active group was more likely to store fat just under the skin instead of around organs, which is much more harmful. Should you meditate when you're stressed? Mindfulness helps focus your attention and keeps you in the present, but researchers think it may not be the best option to de-stress. Instead, being hopeful helps people look to the future and stop dwelling on their anxious thoughts. The research, published in the journal Stress and Health, reveals that feelings of hope are more connected to happiness than being mindful. And finally, got neck pain? It's probably because of your phone. A new study shows that the pain comes from continuous neck exertions that cause muscle fatigue, which exaggerate the cervical spine curvature. Though these are subtle movements, they can cause major mobility issues. The findings are published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And that's Medical Notes this week. I'm Mayan Vasta Betancourt.
Moments like my daughter telling me a new joke mean a lot to me. But after being diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, or MBC, which is breast cancer that has spread to other parts of the body, they mean even more. I take Ibrance, palbociclib.
Ibrance 125 milligram tablets with an aromatase inhibitor is for adults with HR-positive, HER2-negative MBC as the first hormonal-based therapy. Ask your doctor about Ibrance and visit Ibrance.com. Ibrance may cause low white blood cell counts that may lead to serious infections. Ibrance may cause severe inflammation of the lungs. Both of these can lead to death. Tell your doctor right away if you have new or worsening symptoms, including trouble breathing, shortness of breath, cough, or chest pain. Before taking Ibrance, tell your doctor if you have fever, chills, or other signs of infection, liver or kidney problems, are or plan to become pregnant, or are breastfeeding. Common side effects include low red blood cell and low platelet counts, infections, tiredness, nausea, sore mouth, abnormalities in liver blood tests, diarrhea, hair thinning or loss, vomiting, rash, and loss of appetite.
Thank you for joining us this week and every week as we break down the science stories you need to know. You can find all of our past segments and guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and X for daily content. And tune in next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.
This weather update is sponsored by Hansen HVAC Heating and Cooling, your local Armstrong Air dealer of Phillips and Manitouish Waters.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Plenty of clouds around the area, but those will thin out, especially this afternoon. Breezy west to northwest winds up over 30 miles per hour. Highs in the lower to middle 50s. Tonight, mostly clear skies and frosty. Temperatures dropping to the lower 30s. Currently 52 degrees.
This week on Viewpoints.
Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do these monsters come? Just because. There's no rhyme or reason to this.
Spooky season is here. The deeper meanings behind why we enjoy horror stories. Then.
There are already cities in the U.S. which are essentially in unlivable zones.
The reality of forced climate migration. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
What's better than one win? Three wins? With Straight Savings, you keep your own phone, get one line for only $25 a month with real unlimited data, and get rewarded with a $200 phone credit after 12 months. It's a win-win-win. Head to Walmart or visit straighttalk.com today. Switch to Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense. Straight Savings Plan enrollment requires compatible unlocked device and new line of service. Bonus device credit requires 12 months of active service. Offer ends if eligibility requirements are no longer met. Taxes and fees apply. For network management practices, see Straight Talk's terms and conditions.
10 fellows, 5 papers, and 1 unforgettable summer. For 8 years, the Chevrolet Discover the Unexpected Fellowship has been powering the futures of students from historically black colleges and universities. Together, these amazing fellows drive their legacy with a $10,000 scholarship, hands-on mentorship, and the internship of a lifetime. Follow the journey as the Discover the Unexpected Fellows own their stories all summer long at the Chevrolet Tracks. To learn more, visit nnpa.org/ChevyDTU.
It's officially October, and that means a full month dedicated to embracing the darkness, the spooky vibes, the scary, gory stories, and the horrific, unhinged movies that leave you feeling fully unsettled, disturbed, and unable to leave the house after dark. For fans of horror, this is all part of the enjoyment, and right now is peak season to cozy up and dig into old and new favorites. If you're not a fan, it can be hard to understand why people gravitate towards these fear-inducing stories. One expert who's well-read on the subject is Jeremy Dauber, a professor of American Studies at Columbia University and the author of the new book, American Scary, A History of Horror from Salem to Stephen King and Beyond. When looking at the film, shows, and books that make up the genre of horror in the U.S., Dauber says that many of these narratives pull from old beliefs, superstitions, and real-life events. He separates these stories into 2 different categories of fear.
You have these universal, transnational, transcultural fears of stuff that's wide and out there and cosmic and big. That's one bucket of fear. And the other is the monster right next door, the person who you're afraid of, the thing that's right close to you.
Dauber points out that many of these physical and metaphysical fears evolve over the decades and are often driven by what's happening in society at that time. As an example, he jumps back to early American history when European colonists first arrived and brought with them their deeply religious beliefs.
The kind of religion that they have, this Puritanism, is obsessed, I think that's not too strong a word, with the idea that there are diabolic and devilish forces that are kind of all around them. You know, so you have this grand cosmic fear, right, of the devil and whatever, right? But there's also this idea, right, that somehow people who live right in your town or right in your neighborhood could be, even in your household, could be people who are trafficking with some of these evil forces, and you wouldn't necessarily know it, right?
These suspicions led to the Salem witch trials in the late 1600s in colonial Massachusetts. By the end of these hearings, more than 200 people were accused of witchcraft and 19 died by hanging. Fast forward to now, and the idea of witches and dark forces roaming among us is still a popular topic in the horror genre. Personally, we love films like The Witch and The Blair Witch Project. Moving on from witches, Dauber also touches on how some of the best horror movies are metaphors for real-life political and international issues. Go back to a post-World War II America in the 1950s, and the threat of nuclear annihilation by the Soviet Union was very real.
There were also lots of movies that said, we're going to take that fear, we're going to put it into a more monstrous fictional form, like an alien invasion. We have this version of the War of the Worlds, for example, that comes out of the 1950s. And even though clearly they're Martians, you know, this is a way of saying, well, they're not really Martians. They're kind of communists, communist Martians, so to speak, right? That's a way of working out these fears.
In the 1980s, when HIV/AIDS in the U.S. was a big fear, there was a big uptake in this subgenre of horror.
Vampire fiction and vampire movies really became very, very popular in some ways because that kind of infectious virality, really the metaphor that the vampires were part of, really spoke as a kind of metaphor for the concerns that people had about this, at that point, unknown disease, right? This disease that people didn't quite understand where it came from, how it was spread, all of those sort of things. And that became a very powerful way of thinking through this.
And the image of what a vampire looks or acts like has also changed over time. Those of us who are older may imagine Count Dracula in a black cape with a pale white face and piercing red eyes, but for the younger generation, many see a younger, sexier vampire like Edward Cullen from the Twilight series or Eric Northman from True Blood.
We have such an explosion now of horror shows, or there's horror movies, horror fiction. And you have all of these different kinds of opportunities to present these characters in different ways. And you can have these romances, you can have these paranormal romances, where the vampire becomes a kind of very different sort of figure than simply the kind of old-fashioned tuxedo and cape figure from the 1930s and the 1940s. And that's interesting to kind of track.
Whether it's movies about zombies or murderous killers, it's the directors and writers who transform these characters into something new. Some of the best directors in the genre, like John Carpenter and Wes Craven, have created series that have spanned decades. Today, there's new up-and-comers like Jordan Peele. You might be familiar with some of his hits like Us and Get Out.
What Peele is doing, and you know, he's not the first person ever to have harnessed horror and social criticism or social satire, but he's really doing it in a way that is sort of, I think, very powerful, very profound, and very much speaks to our present moment, to a particular moment, which is our present. And Peele, of course, gets his background in comedy, right? He was, before he became this sort of incredibly and deservedly lauded director of horror movies, right? He was part of this Comedy Central sketch show, Key and Peele. And what he really is able to do is to present this horrible story in a movie like Get Out of body snatching and, you know, predation and racism, right, with a kind of satiric eye. I think, you know, he's got an amazing vision and an amazing mind. And, you know, all of the movies that he's directed so far have been illuminating and interesting and often quite scary, which is nice if that's what you like. And I certainly do.
If you love horror like we do, this month is all about revisiting some of our favorites. So, what's a top recommendation from Dauber? He highlights an old-school American film from the 50s called The Night of the Hunter,
which is based originally, with a lot of changes, on an actual true-life Lonely Hearts killer, right? But it is turned in the hands of this director, Charles Laughton, into something which is kind of a dark fairy tale of the American condition. And I think that if you see it and you see this Robert Mitchum chasing and these two children, essentially, for reasons that I will not go into, you'll have to see it. It is not a forgettable movie, and I highly recommend it and envy anyone who watches it their first viewing.
To find out more about the evolution of horror in U.S. pop culture, head to viewpointsradio.org for more links and resources. You can also check out Jeremy Dauber's new book, American Scary, A History of Horror from Salem to Stephen King and Beyond, now available online and in select bookstores. For more behind the scenes and to support our show, follow Viewpoints Radio on Instagram, X, and Facebook. This story was written and produced by our executive producer, Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price. This summer, Chevrolet and the National Newspaper Publishers Association are teaming up for the 8th year of the Discover the Unexpected Fellowship, where 10 exceptional HBCU students vie to receive a $10,000 scholarship and internship of a lifetime with Black-owned newspapers. To learn more, visit nnpa.org/ChevyDTU.
Coming up, how have changing weather patterns affected your life when Viewpoints returns?
Good morning, Doctor.
Doctor.
Hi, Doctor.
Doctor?
Dr. Jackson's practice is growing.
What do you mean we're still short-staffed?
He needs a good patient doctor.
How do we not have enough doctors to doctor all these patients?
And he doesn't have the patience to sift through hundreds of resumes.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. When you sponsor a job on Indeed, it's easier for talented candidates to find it, which makes it easier for you to hire them. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
A new era of chicken is here to stay, and it's not your parents' poultry. The Cantina Chicken menu from Taco Bell is slow-roasted and perfectly seasoned. Take it tacoed up in a crispy white corn tortilla with cheese inside and out, or wrapped in a burrito with fresh purple cabbage and freshly prepared pico de gallo. However you like it, you'll never chicken the same way again. Get yours today at your nearest Taco Bell and join rewards to earn free food. Available at participating stores, rewards points are earned on qualifying purchases. All items while supplies last, subject to terms.
With Progressive Snapshot, you could save on auto insurance rates by driving safely, which is great because you're rarely rewarded for just being you. Ever get rewarded for being left-handed? No. You get to use weird scissors. Your reward for being a Capricorn? Cold birthdays that conflict with the holidays? And your reward for quickly responding to every work email? More emails. But with Snapshot, even left-handed Capricorns with proper email etiquette could get rewarded for good driving. So download the Progressive app today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Snapshot not available in all states or from all agents.
You can do it all by yourself. Whoa, baby girl. What's your name? Let me talk to you. Let me buy you a drink.
Spilled your drink? Quick, the quicker picker-upper. Bounty picks up spills quicker. And each sheet is 2 times more absorbent, so you can use less than the leading ordinary brand. So, you can get back to your night. Bounty, the quicker picker-upper.
Across the U.S., millions of people are being uprooted from their homes and forced to migrate, not because of war or economic hardship, but by the climate. Between rising sea levels, submerging coastal communities, and towns being destroyed by severe weather, millions are being forced to say goodbye to their homes in search of safety and stability. But what exactly does it mean to be a climate migrant?
Climate change, the disasters, the extreme conditions that we're already experiencing and which will get worse. And I'm talking about things like more violent storms, extreme flooding, extreme and chronic heat, drought, which affects crops and pushes up food prices. Fire is another one. All of these will exacerbate the conditions under which people live and make places more and more unlivable and push them to move.
That's Gaia Vince, science writer and author of Nomad Century: How Climate Migration Will Reshape Our World. According to a report by the First Street Foundation, it's estimated that 3.2 million Americans are already climate migrants, and that number is expected to keep rising. But many of these people don't even realize they fall into this category.
Quite often they will see themselves not as climate migrants, but perhaps as economic migrants or people who have moved for other reasons, you know, to get a different job. I've met many communities from rural places where they've moved to the city in order to get jobs. But actually, if you dig it a bit deeper, the reason they've made the move is because they've had chronic drought, which has affected the agriculture there. And even if they're not directly farmers or not directly living off their agricultural production, just being within that community becomes harder and harder because there's a lot less money to go around. And so other entrepreneurs also find it more difficult.
While some don't know their status, others are very aware of their precarious situation. One example is Patrick Garvey, a climate migrant from the Florida Keys. In 2013, Garvey bought Grimmel Grove, a neglected tropical fruit grove on the island. He had hopes of turning it around and growing fruits rare to the U.S. But as soon as his business took off, Hurricane Irma swept in.
August 2017. We finally had our first profit, and 10 days later, Hurricane Irma destroys the property, the business, and my personal life.
Though Garvey escaped the hurricane physically okay, the same can't be said for his property. After sheltering at a nearby school during the storm, he returned home to find wood and metal strewn everywhere. His grove was destroyed, and most of the trees were now bare stumps. While many of his friends and neighbors left the Keys for good, Garvey relocated within the archipelago. He also rebuilt his business, but it took a very long time.
The hurricane affected the whole dynamic of the Keys, population-wise, housing-wise, cost of living increased. For the Keys, for the longest time, affordable housing is typically having a trailer. And once that trailer is destroyed in a hurricane, you cannot put a trailer back. It has to be a single family residence, which is, you know, a lot more money to be able to put in. So a lot of people left.
Unfortunately, many Americans can relate to his experience. Hurricanes are wiping out communities along the East and Gulf coasts. Tornadoes are ravaging the Midwest and South. And wildfires are becoming more frequent and deadly in the West and Northwest. On top of that, extreme heat is also making some of the nation's largest cities unlivable.
There is a survivability limit, which is the temperature at which a young, healthy person who is not doing any physical activity will die within 6 hours. Now, that human survivability limit had not been exceeded anywhere until on Earth, until about 5 years ago when it was first experienced in Oman in the desert. It's now been experienced in the United States in several places around the world, and that's only going to increase. There are already cities in the US which are essentially in unlivable zones. I mean, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, Las Vegas, they're only made livable because of huge amounts of adaptation of these air-conditioned units. And that's fine for a very small, wealthy population, but it does rely on having huge access to energy.
And while there are many Americans who've moved to cooler, more stable climates, there are others who want to but can't.
What ends up happening is you get this kind of climate apartheid where the wealthy people can actually afford to migrate to safety and to better conditions. And the poor people become stuck because they can't afford to move. The value of their property is diminished and they can't afford to buy elsewhere. And at the same time, the whole neighborhood starts to deteriorate in value for these kind of accumulative reasons. And that's something that really governments and city planners need to get on top of.
Currently, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, known as FEMA, provides financial assistance to people impacted by natural disasters. However, the average payout is only $3,000 and can take months to receive. And there's no preventative assistance program to help those in high-risk areas relocate somewhere else before disaster strikes. For these reasons, many in the climate community are advocating for managed retreats or strategic planned relocations of people and infrastructure. While this may seem like a perfect solution, it requires both funding and transparency from government officials.
We need honesty from leaders about what New York City will look like, what Seattle will look like, what Las Vegas, New Orleans, Los Angeles, what will they look like in 2040? What will they look like in 2060? What are we expecting to see those conditions in those places? And then we need to have discussions about how we manage this and how we plan for it. And that will involve moving people, investments, industry, agriculture. You know, this is not just a migration of a few individuals. This is a migration of capital, of resources, of everything.
Sadly, the Florida Keys are one of the places experts recommend for a managed retreat. If sea levels keep rising, the islands are expected to be non-existent in just a few decades. Garvey knows he may become a climate migrant once again, but he's not giving up hope just yet. After rebuilding Grimmel Grove, he decided to join the fight against climate change by growing breadfruit. These trees can not only survive harsh climates, but absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. For him, it's a reminder that there are solutions to this crisis.
Breadfruit is a tree that is disaster resilient. It was one of the few trees that survived the hurricane. And it also sequesters more carbon than any other staple crop in the world. So it actually helps mitigate the global warming. So that's kind of been my focus, is to kind of create a positive or a something for the future.
The fight to minimize climate change is solvable, but there's a clock counting down. Every year without change will bring a larger number of climate migrants and new challenges. To find out more about Gaia Vince, Patrick Garvey, and all of our featured guests, visit viewpointsradio.org. You can find Vince's book, Nomad Century: How Climate Migration Will Reshape Our World, on Amazon.com, or request copies to be stocked at your local bookstore. For more behind the scenes, check out Viewpoints Radio on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. This segment was written and produced by Grace Galanti. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Studio production by Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson. This segment is brought to you by Capital One. With no fees or minimums and no overdraft fees, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. Member FDIC.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment. Moments like hearing my cat purr good morning mean a lot to me. But after being diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, or MBC, which is breast cancer that has spread to other parts of the body, they mean even more. I take Ibrance, palbociclib.
Ibrance 125 milligram tablets with an aromatase inhibitor is for adults with HR-positive, HER2-negative MBC as the first hormonal-based therapy. Ask your doctor about Ibrance and visit Ibrance.com. Ibrance may cause low white blood cell counts that may lead to serious infections. Ibrance may cause severe inflammation of the lungs. Both of these can lead to death. Tell your doctor right away if you have new or worsening symptoms, including trouble breathing, shortness of breath, cough, or chest pain. Before taking Ibrance, tell your doctor if you have fever, chills, or other signs of infection, liver or kidney problems, are or plan to become pregnant, or are breastfeeding. Common side effects include low red blood cell and low platelet counts, infections, tiredness, nausea, sore mouth, abnormalities in liver blood tests, diarrhea, hair thinning or loss, vomiting, rash, and loss of appetite.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. During the presidential debate earlier this month, immigration policy was a hot-button issue. In general, there's been a lot of coverage the past 2 years around the hundreds of thousands of asylum-seeking migrants who've crossed into the U.S. from the southern border. Most of these individuals and families come from Central and South America and have been displaced due to war, poverty, crime, and even climate change. For instance, over the past 2 years, more than 7 million citizens have left Venezuela due to extremely high inflation, crime, and political repression. That's nearly a quarter of the overall population. Today, several U.S. cities are still trying to figure out what's next for this population who've gotten stuck in international limbo. Head up north to the U.S.-Canada border, and there's another immigration issue brewing. This year, when compared to last year, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency has reported a 95% increase in illegal crossings from Canada into the U.S. So what's driving this huge influx? Immigration experts haven't pieced together the whole story yet, but a large number of these illegal immigrants are Indian and Canadian nationals. In a recent NPR story, migrants stated feeling that there were more career and economic opportunities for them in the U.S. in comparison to Canada, where they face lower wages, higher taxes, and fewer open jobs. While the future may remain uncertain, one thing is clear. Immigration policy will continue to be a top-ranking issue for voters this November. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. It's officially fall, which means the rush to watch horror movies is on, and one of the best body horror movies in years is in theaters now. It's called The Substance. It comes from writer-director Coralie Farjah. It stars Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley, and it is absolutely bonkers. At times, a painfully honest portrayal of addiction, body dysmorphia, and aging, and at others, a stomach-churning, R-rated body horror movie with some truly disturbing and upsetting images. The Substance is about an aging Hollywood star named Elizabeth Sparkle, who's fired from her job hosting an exercise show on her birthday. Feeling dejected, she injects a black market drug simply called The Substance, which makes a younger, more beautiful version of herself. If she follows the instructions carefully, The Substance should help her without a hitch. But this is a body horror movie, so you can trust some horrific side effects come into play. Winner of this year's Best Screenplay Award at the Cannes Film Festival, The Substance showcases Demi Moore especially in what might be a career-best performance, gives audiences something to think about, and leaves them feeling absolutely grossed out. A body horror masterpiece, indeed. If gross-out horror isn't your thing, though, this fall still has plenty of other horror options in store. A new film version of Stephen King's classic novel Salem's Lot was just released on Max. Netflix is scheduled to release a few horror movies of their own, with Platform 2 already streaming, and Don't Move streaming beginning on October 25th. Meanwhile, Smile 2 will play in theaters on October 18th, and the original Saw is going to be re-released into theaters on October 20th. And if all that isn't enough, of course, every streaming service will be highlighting horror hits all month long. Let me go out on a limb and recommend some Alfred Hitchcock. If you've never taken the leap before, Psycho is a classic for a reason. Horror fans, your time is now. Pumpkin patches, haunted houses, and trips to the theater to see terrifying things are all on the horizon. I'm Evan Rook.
What's better than one win? Three wins? With Straight Savings, you keep your own phone, get one line for only $25 a month with real unlimited data, and get rewarded with a $200 phone credit after 12 months. It's a win-win-win. Head to Walmart or visit straighttalk.com today. Switch to Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense. Straight Savings Plan enrollment requires compatible unlocked device and new line of service. Bonus device credit requires 12 months of active service. Offer ends if eligibility requirements are no longer met. Taxes and fees apply. For network management practices, see Straight Talk's terms and conditions.
Work is busy. And home?
Mom!
Pretty much the same. But you wouldn't know it because my skin doesn't look stressed thanks to Olay Retinol Body Wash. Its hydrating formula is packed with vitamin B3 complex plus retinol. I use Olay Retinol Body Wash to transform my skin from dry to moisturized and visibly renewed. Sure, I still have stress, but my skin looks amazing. Try Olay Retinol Body Wash for visibly renewed skin in just 14 days. Also try Retinol 24 Body Lotion.
That's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
Oh,
listening to 103.1 FM and 980 AM WPFP Park Falls. This is Trail Mix 103.1.
Yeah!